Welcome to the Fearless Women Podcast. We're inspiring conversations for the unafraid. I'm Janice McDonald, founder of the Beacon Agency, author, and global champion for women. Why am I making this show? Because I want to share the inspiring stories of women leaders in business, arts and culture, politics, and more with all of you. Hear how they've chosen to go forward and be bold and make the world a better place, even when it wasn't easy to do. Subscribe now wherever you find podcasts. Hey, everybody, I'm Janice McDonald. Welcome to the Fearless Women Podcast. Today is a true fangirl moment for me. I'm so honored and so delighted to welcome the impressive trailblazer, a woman who embodies all the best qualities, frankly, of humanity, Lieutenant General Christine Whitecross. Welcome to the Fearless Woman Podcast.
Thanks, Janice. It's a real honor to be here.
And thank you for calling in from Rome. A few things that I need to share about the General's remarkable career of service. Currently, she's Commandant of the Rome Naval Defense College. She has a Bachelor of Engineering, a Master's in Defense and Strategic Studies, is a graduate of Advanced Military Studies and Command and Staff courses, a Commander of the Order of Military Merit. She was named one of Canada's top 100 most powerful women in 2011 and 2016, and that's how we first met and we're on a panel together. She is also the 2018 recipient of the CDAI Vimy Award. She served in Germany, Bosnia, Afghanistan, and across Canada. There's so many more accomplishments in her outstanding career, so I've only highlighted a few. Chris, very excited to talk to you today.
Thanks, Janice. It's a real honor to be here. You have a great program.
Thank you so much. And of course, welcome to our listeners from around the world, including USA, Ireland, UK, and so many more countries. We want our community to grow. Please tell your friends and follow us on Instagram. Thanks also to our amazing sponsors, 30% Club Canada, BDC, Lockheed Martin, Export Development Canada, and ADGA. I'm also excited to share that you can now pre-order my Fearless book on Chapters Indigo. Look up Fearless by Janice McDonald at chapters.ca. Let's get right to it. So first, let's talk about your current role in Rome as Commandant of the NATO Defense College, the first woman and third Canadian to hold this position. What are you up to over there?
Actually, it's kind of even funny that I even got here because I was due to retire in 2015 after 35 years of service. Sorry, 2017 after 35 years of service. But Canada decided to put my name forward for the commandant position. I don't know if you're aware, but in NATO, these sorts of positions are voted on by the military committee. Also, all nations, all 29 nations get a vote. And I was quite elated, but very surprised to even be chosen by the 29 nations to come here to Rome.
So incredible. And so you're there. What's an average day for you over there in the NATO Defense College as Commandant?
It's actually kind of interesting because in my jobs in Canada as a general officer, I actually get to sleep in here. So I don't have to get up till six, which is kind of cool. And my day is really about welcoming individual speakers, practitioners, military leaders from around the world. We're a college that does that looks at the strategic level of issues that influence or pertain to NATO, and we have only very senior people. So it's almost at a master's level, and as the commandant, I'm responsible for the entire college, so the administration and the logistics and all that stuff, but also to support the academic program. We have a research division. So I get to meet a lot of very interesting and very, I would say infamous almost, but people that really challenge the way we think, challenge the way we do business. And so my mornings are basically aligned with that. And then my afternoons, like any other military person or executive person, I deal with the issues that pertain to the business of running a college.
Mm-hmm. So you are very busy, but you're at the forefront of amazing conversations. How does living and working abroad change your view of Canada, if at all? So you're in Rome, but of course you've lived and worked in many countries around the world.
So my very first posting was in Germany, and in fact, I was born there because my father was posted there in the early 60s. So I was delighted to go back. But it didn't really change me much because I worked in amongst Canadians in a very Canadian environment. Mm-hmm. But I have to say, when I deployed to Bosnia-Herzegovina, to the former Yugoslavia, and this was in the mid-90s during the real tension and the hostilities in that region, I was a mother of three very young children, all under the age of five. My husband was military, and even though he knew what I was going through, I knew this was something I had to do alone. And I thought for sure that I would come back a less positive person, a person that maybe challenged the way I thought, and just a whole bunch of other negative things that I never expected. But in fact, that changed 100%. I came back more proud to be Canadian. I came back delighted that my country was serving in an area of the world that may not be geographically near Canada, but was doing great, great things for the greater good and for humanity and for people that needed help. But I also felt that as a Canadian and having seen harsh things, whether it was Bosnia or Afghanistan or anywhere else, that I could come back to a country that respected me, that believed in people, they believed in equality, and it was almost a watershed moment to step off the airplane and think, wow, I mean, this is an entirely different place, and this is something that a place I call home, and I'm really proud of it.
It's incredible, and you've spent, as you said, now over 35 years in service of our country. How did you decide to serve? We heard that your dad served. What was the calling for you? I understand you in university is when you enlisted.
I did. There's a really small unknown fact about Chris Whitecross, better known as Chris Edwards, back in high school. And that's I had applied for a military college when they opened it to women when I was in high school, and I didn't make it.
What?
Which I think kind of ironic today, but that's okay.
That's incredible.
So I went to Queens for engineering. And I was in second year university, and I was walking down Princess Street in Kingston, Ontario, and I saw the recruiting center. And it's just always been something in the back of my mind. My father was military. I have three brothers who are in the reserves. My uncle was military. My grandfather fought in the war. And I thought, I got to try it. I was a cadet when I was in high school. I really enjoyed the structure. I enjoyed the hierarchical aspect of it. But what I really liked was the community and the philosophy of service above self and service to your community and service to your nation. And so I literally walked into the recruiting center, there just so happened to be vacancies for the occupation I was going into. So I got in fairly quickly. I didn't even tell my parents until the day I was being sworn in about a month later. And it just happened so quickly. And and I thought I was just going to try this out for a couple of years, see what it was like. I mean, that's 1982. So that's 37 years ago that I actually walked into the recruiting center. And I really don't regret a day since.
Never look back. And we, as a country, are so much better for your service. What about this? Are there any misconceptions or things you'd like women to know about a career in the military so more women would consider it? It's certainly been a very rewarding career for you. How can we attract more women to defense and security?
You know, that is a real golden question. And one of the things is just, as you said, a misconception about what life in the military is all about. I think people, not just women, but people don't realize that there are over 100 occupations in the military. You don't have to be an infantry person on the ground. You don't have to be a pilot, or you don't have to be driving a ship. You can be a dentist or a lawyer or a doctor or an engineer or a IT specialist. I mean, there's so many opportunities, 105, I think, occupations at last count. And so there's really something for everyone. And there are you don't have to be in the regular force. You can serve as a reservist and serve in your local community. And choose to go outside your local community for other good work. It's just we need to educate people better on what a military life is. Now, the reality is it's not for everyone. There are, you have to I mean, I think you have to be prepared for the challenges that a military life will give you. You have to take opportunities that you may not have ever thought about in the past. You have to be willing to travel, to do new things, and to work in sometimes very difficult and challenging environments, and we're with difficult and challenging people. And sometimes you're working in almost a surprise every day. So it's not necessarily for everyone, but those who seek something completely out of the norm, where they can serve their country and they can be in amongst, I would say, some tremendously gifted and talented and inspiring people, I mean, they should give it a try.
Mm-hmm. Love that. Well, we heard it from you, so it's time for people to think about it, because it's an exciting career possibility. Take us back, mm-hmm. Chris, to the 10-year-old you. What was that girl like? Where were you living? Where, I know you started your life in Germany, where you were born, but where were you at 10, and what were you into?
Well, my father was military, so we did move around a lot. So 10 would have been 1972. That gives away my age. So that would have been North Bay. So a military family kind of judges where they are by their age or the year. And so I would have been living in North Bay at the time, probably grade 5, because I was born in the fall. So I'm a little younger in my class. Mm-hmm. And I was, fundamentally, I was naive. I was a 10-year-old. I was very naive. I lived in a loving family that didn't really have a lot. Mm-hmm. And we were okay with that because we didn't know any better, to be honest. Mm-hmm. But I didn't, things like equality and all that kind of stuff just was never part of my psyche. I was pretty shy. I was less, didn't particularly have a lot of friends, which is not really uncommon with people who move around a lot. I was really afraid to make mistakes or to do things wrong. And that's my 10-year-old me. Mm-hmm. But I also was big into sports. I was a happy person. And I just loved life. And I wanted to do good things. But I didn't know what that meant. I looked up to adults. I liked to try new things. And those are all, many of those things that are, espouse me as an adult as well. But really, if I was to look at my younger self, I'd say I was pretty self-conscious. I was a really great in school and in sports, but I came from a family, a big family where traditional responsibilities were fairly normal, I sort of learned from that.
Mm-hmm. And you've gone on to do so many remarkable things, but being a foster parent is another remarkable thing that you've done. It's been a big part of your life. Can you share the journey of how you started being a foster parent? And is the number correct, 33 children?
That is correct, yes. I think we were in Nova Scotia at the time, my husband and I. And we have three of our own children. We have a stepdaughter as well, his daughter from a previous marriage. But we have our three children. And when the youngest was about 4 or 5, I think, we had seen this advertisement looking for foster parents. And Ian, my husband, didn't really know what that meant. So I explained to him my understanding of it. And so, you know, it took a while, but I convinced him we should go to an information night, which we did. And we went through the process. And I think the hardest part was discussing it with our children. Once Ian and I had decided that this is something that we really wanted to do, first of all, we love children. I mean, the more the merrier. Mm-hmm. But we needed to discuss it with our own children so that we could manage expectations, and we didn't want to put them through something that they didn't feel comfortable about doing. So we had one of our infamous family meetings, and we brought up the subject, and it described to a probably 5, 7, and 8-year-old. What it meant to be to take a stranger into your home and to nurture them and to try to take care of them and to love them and to embrace them as much as possible, depending on how their background was, so that when they left, they were a better person and they could cope with society, sort of thing. And I think in as much as the children were young, I think it resonated with them. And through that discussion, we decided to take the course. Mm-hmm. It's provincially legislated, of course, so every province is different. And then we got posted to another province, and we took course again, which in some respects would think, well, maybe why did you go through with it? But we did. And it's been such a delight. We have had 33 children come through our home, and I'd say 95% of them were babies.
Wow.
Under the age of two.
Wow.
And which was one of the decisions our own children made, was that we not take in any children that were older than them.
Okay.
And I think it's not only has it been satisfying and just embracing for Ian and I, it has been a tremendous teaching venue for our own children, who I think are going to be better parents for it, mm-hmm. Who understand the difference between how they're brought up and how some other people are brought up. And so there's empathy and tolerance and a real transparency and openness that I don't think they would have gotten as intensively as they could have. Being a foster parent is also a lot of work. And it's very, very emotional, especially when they leave. And every single time we had a child come in, you love them, you take care of them, and then, of course, they leave. Mm-hmm. Some leave into much better situations, and some, into situations that they had come from. And it's a tough haul, but it was such a gift to us to be able to do that for all those children.
33, that's absolutely remarkable. And how long typically would a child stay in your home?
Well, we were long-term care. So you have people that take them for respite, to take them as an emergency care. But we could have them generally not less than 6 months. And on average between 18 and, say, 36 months.
Oh, wow. That's...
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. So you form really
part of the family
powerful.
By then.
Yes. Yeah. Beautiful bond. So I would imagine that would be very challenging for everybody when you have to separate. But then
it's
you welcome
really
somebody
difficult,
new.
Not just for Ian and I, but for our children
yes.
as well. But
yes.
One of the really interesting stories, though, is some of them we have connected with us through Facebook, which I think is just fantastic. Because whenever they left, we would write them a letter and send them a photo album with them so that they would have a little piece of us with them. And those who, wanted to, certainly, two of them have reached out, which is kind of interesting.
That's beautiful.
Kind of beautiful, yeah.
Yeah. And so your husband also served in the military, but then resigned to take care of your children. That's very inspiring to have that kind of support for you in your career and for your children.
Absolutely. So when I was deployed to the former Yugoslavia, when Ian and I, and one of the times where I got to see him throughout the year, we really talked about what was our priority for our own children. And, do we want to continue with the daycares or do we want somebody at home? We're a little old fashioned that way. And then the question was not so much do we want someone at home, but who should stay at home? Well, his answer was pretty funny. It was, he had a job and I had a career, so the decision was easy. But it wasn't that easy. This, you're talking the mid-90s.
Yeah.
When it was uncommon for a man to stay at home and take care of the children. And he was, I'm inspired by my own husband. He's the one that took care of those 33 foster children and was really their surrogate parent, a mother and father for... I put in long days and he's the one at home taking care of everybody. But it was a great decision for us. It doesn't hit for everybody, but for us it was great. And I think for our children, it really set them up.
So given all the things that you've done and the things that you've seen, it sort of feels like a silly question to ask you, given that you do courage for a living. But what's the last thing you've done that scared you? If anything.
I mean, that's a tough question. Yeah. I think work-wise, I was scared when I went to Bosnia, for sure. That was in the mid-90s. I didn't know what to expect. I was going into a strange place, and I knew that it was hostile. And, and I was in my mid-30s by then. And things happened in Bosnia that scared me. Personal situations that I was in. I was scared when I went to Afghanistan. I was terrified to go to Afghanistan, knowing that we'd lost soldiers there and that there was intensive fighting. And it was difficult to identify the actual insurgent, the actual terrorist, because of, you know, people dressed alike and all that kind of stuff. So, I was terrified at that. But it's interesting, in my line of work, you kind of use that to dig deep, to carry on and do what you need to do, because that's who you are, and that's the way you were brought up in the military. I grew up in the military. I joined when I was 19. Mm-hmm. I'll be 57 this month. And this was my life. I literally grew up from high school right into a military career. And you learn that when situations are difficult and you need to, that little extra to push you forward, that you get that from your gut. And you move forward knowing that your people depend upon you, that the situation demands it. And that you're trained for it, and mm-hmm. that they would never put you in a situation that you couldn't deal with, in terms of work. I mean, I've been scared at other times, but when I was in Afghanistan, my husband had a heart attack. That scared me, completely threw me for a loop. And luckily the Canadian government sent me home in time, to take care of him for a couple of weeks before I went back. But, you know, when it comes to family, it's harder to reach in. I mean, you still do it. Because it's family. But when it comes to work in a military environment, I mean, you do what you need to do because you have to do it. And I, that probably sounds really, I don't know, trite. But you know, it's honesty. I think it's just the way we are.
It sounds very inspiring, actually. Nothing trite about it. So what's your advice for ambitious women to get ahead in their careers?
I have a lot of advice for anybody who wants to get ahead in their careers, and particularly, I think, women. I think, first of all, planning is important, kind of knowing where you're going. But you can't stick to a plan. You have to feel confident that when an opportunity knocks, even though it's not part of your plan, that you need to take it. You need to see where it brings you. I had no idea on some of the postings or positions or authorities that I was going to be given. And some of them were a complete surprise to me. And what they did was they gave me a completely different perspective, a completely different set of competencies and skills that I needed to move forward. So my number one piece of advice for people moving forward is take those opportunities, even though they're not part of your glide path. And I think the other one is, which I probably talk about way too much, is know how to communicate. And communication is everything from knowing who those people you need to target your message to how to give a briefing, how to be concise, how to read, how to write, how to listen, how to develop policy that communicates your ideas, how to best and don't limit your audience, you know, so really capture your ideas and be able to communicate that to a very large expanse of people. And I think my last piece of advice would be always be humble. Nobody gets to where they are without the people behind them or the people beside them or the people ahead of them. And we have to share our success with those people that helped us moving forward. And we need to be humble. And I think that is being humble is underrated and underutilized. And, you know, I wish that it was talked about more in mainstream, because it isn't about us. It's about the group, the company, the occupation, the opportunities that we're given. It's greater than us, the success is moving forward.
How has your leadership style evolved?
Oh, it changes a lot. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I was young, it was smaller groups and the smaller tasks and the responsibilities weren't as challenging or complex. To now when I'm much more mature and I have to change my leadership style depending on the task and depending on the target audience. If I'm deployed, it's far more directive. If I'm in a group that's working on policies or brainstorming, it's far more conciliatory. I think the leadership style evolves with the narrative and with the target audience, but it's always still shows your competencies. You're unafraid to move forward and to seek new ideas and to embrace people and to let them know what they're providing is important. The underpinning foundations of the leadership, I think, don't change, but how you interact with people as you go through your careers and as you go through the different sort of responsibility frameworks that you're doing, I think that's where the changes come.
And your experiences and the additional training, et cetera, I guess, influences it.
Well, we're really lucky in the military. I mean, we get training and education, what we call professional military education, at certain developmental times during your entire career. Nobody else, I don't think, in the federal government, certainly, and in other organizations in Canada, get that structure around to create the best set of competencies and the best set of talents and ideology moving forward as you go through in rank or as you go through in appointments. Because we believe in lifelong learning. We believe as a professional military force that we have to constantly be challenging ourselves and challenging our people and challenging the institution to make things better.
For sure. I can't imagine any other career path that offers that kind of laid out leadership training all the way along, which is really incredible. And you have a degree. I mean, you have so much training and so much education. You have a degree in chemical engineering. Why do we need more women in STEM?
Well, first of all, we're good at it. Historically, women have been not necessarily pushed into the STEM subjects. They have been considered, talking centuries ago, considered not smart enough for it. Probably even at the turn of the century. And so that's a fallacy. I mean, the fact is, we're pretty clever. And women and men, men are clever too, but women and men think differently, right? So when you have the same men and women or diverse group, it doesn't matter if it's just gender or otherwise, in a group talking about things, whether it's technical or otherwise, I mean, your opportunity to have a better solution multiplies, because you're bringing people together that have the same technical background, but they might think a little bit differently. Women, I think, are probably a little bit more comprehensive thinkers. So we think not just outside the box, but we think about other things that will be impeded, second and third order effects kind of things on stuff. So I think that this is really, really great. But I think women are really strong leaders as well. And when you put the STEM with the leadership qualities, I mean, and the fact that they're strong and compassionate people, and that's, of course, not mutually exclusive, what you have is, you have opportunities for inspiration, for innovation, that you wouldn't get if you're only concentrating on half the population.
Absolutely. Better outcomes with diverse and inclusive opportunities, for sure.
Absolutely.
So what's something that you wish you knew earlier?
Something I wish I knew earlier. You know, it took me 15 to 30 years to wear a skirt to work.
Wow.
So our uniforms have skirts and pants. And I know then there is a point to where I'm going here. So and I've told people that, and they kind of look at me strange. But the reason I say that is it took me a long time to realize it was okay to embrace the fact that I'm a woman. And not just embrace it, but celebrate it. And it's okay because people know you're a woman. I mean, I can't be naive about it.
Right.
But to not be afraid to showcase the fact that that I'm a woman, I'm good at what I do, I belong here, and I need to celebrate who I am. And it surprises me today, 2019, that in the late 90s and maybe even the early 2000s, that I don't think I was in that headspace. And I wish I had known that earlier. And I wish I had embraced it earlier and been able to foster it amongst my female colleagues.
And has the change come because also maybe the military itself is more welcoming in that capacity, or is this more about you? Or a little bit of both?
I think it's both. I am in an occupation as an engineer that have very few women, of course more today than back when I joined, but very few women. So I was always surrounded by men, and you know, I didn't want to be the odd man out. That probably was use of words, but I didn't want to be singled out.
Yes.
And so I think that that fell part into play, but I don't think that that's what they expected. I don't think that they would have cared if I had worn a skirt. I think it was me. It was me trying to think through something that probably wasn't really a problem. Mm-hmm. But the reality is, I mean, the Canadian Armed Forces has gone through some significant change in the last, certainly the last 30 years. But I would say even more so in the last decade. My last job before Chief Military Personnel, before coming to Rome, was, of course, the commander of the response team for sexual misconduct to eradicate it. And I think that really put that topic on the table for people who hadn't thought about it because it wasn't a part of their reality. And it isn't a part of most people's reality. With that, and I think just with the numbers of talented, inspirational, innovative, smart, fit, bilingual women that are out there, the society is just changing. And it's changing to a point where, you know, everybody's embracing it. Mm-hmm. I mean, if I could give something to my, I have two daughters, if I could give something to my two daughters, it would be that. It would be embrace who you are, feel comfortable with who you are because you belong where you are.
And you've received significant recognition for being who you are and leading and so many prestigious awards. We mentioned your Vimy Award in 2018 and also Commander of the Order of Military Merit and the U.S. Defense Meritorious Service Award, and WXN Women's Executive Network also recognized you. Why does recognition matter for women, and what do these awards mean to you?
Well, I've always been surprised when I get an award, and I don't know if I'm just being naive or if I was just being naive or not. I mean, certainly the Vimy Award absolutely threw me for a loop. And I think it's okay to be surprised because, you know, I go back to the fact that I think we need to be humble. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it should ever be an expectation. But what it really means is that people are looking at you, they're listening to you, they're seeing what you're capable of. And I think, why is it important to recognize it? I think because we've always recognized, excuse me for saying this, but we've always recognized men. Mm-hmm. So why wouldn't we recognize people that do good work? I mean, and it's also a visual sign to other people. It's a visual sign to others that, you know, if they can do it, then I can do that too. And quite frankly, they deserve it. So why would we hold back on it? And recognition isn't meant to be a one-time thing. Recognition is about who you are and what you do in the whole you, not just your work you, but you know how you are as a person. And I think that's a tremendous accolade for anybody that is, you know, whether government or academic or you know, like you, an entrepreneur and doing a whole bunch of other things, just to be acknowledged by your peers. It's a tremendous sense. It's a humbling sense, but it's a sense of that people, not that I'm looking for it, but people have noticed the goodness that comes from this work. Mm-hmm.
Well, you've done so much good work. You're such an inspiration. Final question for you. What is your dream, General, for Canada?
Well, as I mentioned before, I mean, I've deployed a couple of times now and I've seen some pretty terrible things, and I've been through some harsh realities. I've also seen some tremendously inspiring things and inspiring people. And through it all, I can tell you that people look up to Canadians. They look up to when they see the maple flag on our uniforms, or when they know that you're a Canadian in a conference or something, you know, they know who you are because of what you stand for, your values, your sense of equality, your the fact that, you know, democracy, rule of law, all that kind of stuff, that we embrace diversity and we continue to be an example to many, 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 many countries. And it makes me really, really, really proud. So my dream is really to showcase who we are as Canadians, to maintain the pride that we have for the right reasons, and really not to apologize for coming from the fact that we're coming from the greatest country in the world.
Hear, hear. I couldn't agree more. An inspiring dream for Canada from an incredibly inspiring woman. Thank you again, Lieutenant General Chris Whitecross, for coming on the Fearless Woman podcast today.
Thank you, Janice. It was a real pleasure to be here.
Thanks for listening. We want our community to grow. Tell your friends, follow us on Instagram, and sign up for our newsletter at fearlesswomenpodcast.com to get the early scoop. Thanks again to our amazing sponsors, 30% Club Canada, BDC, Lockheed Martin, Export Development Canada, and ADCA. Subscribe in Apple Podcasts or in your favorite app. And if you like what you hear, give us a 5-star rating. I'm Janice McDonald. Stay fearless. Thank you to the 30% Club Canada for your support of the Fearless Women podcast. The 30% Club believes that gender balance on boards and in senior management not only encourages better leadership and governance, but diversity further contributes to better all-around board performance and ultimately increased corporate performance for both companies and their shareholders. Want to learn more? Visit their website, 30%club.org, and select the Canada chapter to find out about membership, supporters, and key resources. Thank you to Export Development Canada, the international risk experts, for your support of the Fearless Women podcast. Supporting Canadian companies of all sizes succeed on the world stage. EDC takes your worries away and helps you grow your business with confidence. When your business has no borders, neither does your potential. Find out more at edc.ca/women in trade. Thank you to BDC, the bank devoted exclusively to entrepreneurs, for your support of the Fearless Women podcast. We love smart companies that want to amplify women's voices. For more information, go to bdc.ca/women.